First Annual Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis, May 25th to 27th, 1984, held at the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute for Rehabilitation, Warm Springs, Georgia. Tape K201-12, panel discussion on research and management issues.
We're going to get...
The Yale Clinic and Nancy and Bruno are going to be... You want to see the thing?
We have six reports.
I don't know.
For those of you who are here to... It's not here. No, that's funny. It is on, but it's just not loud.
He's going to bring
it up. He needs to turn it. Testing, testing.
Can we turn up mic number one that used to be on the podium that has now been changed to the table? Thank you.
Hello, hello.
You're on now.
Tasting. We have six reports, and the one that I was going to ask to be presented last, because of time constraints on Mr. Moran's part, we have moved to the first. So, Mr. Ellis Moran, the director of Warm Springs Institute, the Roosevelt Warm Springs Institute, is going to talk briefly on our discussion and deliberations regarding future meetings. Mr. Moran.
Thank you. I appreciate you moving me to first. I met with a group of people. Several of us met at lunch yesterday to discuss whether or not we should have or what should be the follow-up of this meeting this weekend. We discussed several options. I shared with the group some of the things that, and many of those that have been involved in the planning are aware of some of the things that has happened as a result of this particular meeting. One of the things that we've had a lot of inquiries about was in reference to patients being able to attend this particular symposium. We've had, very frankly, a lot of difficulty explaining to them what this meeting was all about and why it was not appropriate for them to attend this particular symposium. As a result of that, we felt like that there needs to be some kind of follow-up of this meeting that is made available both in the nature of the possibility of a meeting as well as publication. The idea concerning publication of the proceedings will be addressed by someone else in a minute. But it was suggested that we may want to do two things, or not may, but should do two things. One would be to have some type of presentation made at the St. Louis meeting that's in May. I see the folks that are organizing it aren't here. It's
May 11th and 12th, I think.
Yes. May
10 to the 12th, 1985.
Right. And we think that would be a very important thing to do, and we would be working toward that end as far as making this information available to a broader audience, and particularly to the former polio patients. The other issue has to do with another meeting similar to this. And there were several things that we discussed in the session. One was to bring other disciplines into this particular, if we had another meeting similar to this, that we should bring other medical disciplines into this particular symposium. It was discussed that maybe a lot of people, surgeons, family practice folks out in the community and around the country are getting questions from polio patients, and it would be good to broaden the group. But in any case, we decided that it was very important to have a meeting of this nature sometime with hopefully within the next 12 months, and in fact it was suggested that we look at June of next year as a follow-up meeting. We discussed several alternatives as to location. I suggested that we would be delighted to host the occasion again, since we consider this a very important part of our mission. I also suggested that I think we can probably find some of the funding necessary to support this activity. So at the present time, we're talking tentatively about holding a similar symposium next June here at the Institute, and we'll be working out details. So in summary, there were three things that were discussed: publication, which will be mentioned later, the idea of having some type of meeting that would be available for the larger polio population, and we felt that could be addressed in St. Louis if the folks organizing that would be so gracious to invite us. And in fact, I believe you did invite some of the participants or have some type of presentation. And the other one is another meeting similar to this, and hopefully in June of next year. Did that cover it?
Yeah. Thanks very much. Since you did mention publications, let me just take the time now to mention what the plans are. I think as all of you who were presenters here this weekend know, one of the major goals of this symposium, in addition to sharing information here, was to try to collect together between the covers of a book the information that was exchanged here so that we could share it with colleagues who were not able to be here, as well as other interested persons, polio survivors and others, not only in this country but abroad. So we still are committed to publishing, and we have several publishers who in fact have expressed a very strong interest in assisting us with that. I'm delighted to say that the vast majority of the presenters did come with the manuscript, and for those very few of you who still are with an incomplete manuscript but working on it, I simply reaffirm my commitment to getting the publication out as soon as possible and urge your cooperation with that. The second publication that we have been considering, and I think as this meeting has progressed, the importance of that has increased, and that is that we would like to consider doing a much smaller publication, which would be primarily targeted for the lay public in terms of a synopsis of the major presentations that were shared during this symposium that would summarize for interested persons what went on, the facts, as well as the recommendations that are coming out from the panel this morning. So those are the plans for the publication. It cannot be done alone. I'm going to need the help of many of you in terms of helping to finish up the manuscripts. Thank you. Why don't we move on to the second report?
Thanks, Ellis.
There's no particular order, but Ken, would you report on your group and the topic of developing a clinical evaluation protocol?
For the 47th time, I'm Parsons from Denver. The charge to our committee was to identify information needed to more clearly define the clinical problems that patients face, to establish guidelines for clinicians in order for comparable data to be collected in various centers, to develop guidelines for follow-up in terms of frequency, intensity, and workup requirements, and to outline parameters within the clinical setting which will guide and supplement research efforts, to use the basic research information to enhance clinical efforts. Now, we had a very excellent group and a productive 45 minutes together. We generated a great deal of information, which I will put together in a type form and will distribute with the proceeding. So I'm not sure just how beneficial it would be to take a lot of time to read through the whole document in great detail, but I do want to hit some highlights. And in a conceptual framework, and the conceptual framework goes something like this. Who should be doing this sort of thing? What kind of physician input needs to be involved? Should it be just rehab physicians? Should we involve orthopedists? Should we involve pulmonary physicians? Does every clinic need to have an electromyographer, or do we need to have centralized sorts of clinics where people with a high degree of experience in the more sophisticated electrical testing techniques, where those people are available to do the workups. Clearly, the kind of clinic that we're talking about is going to be a multidisciplinary clinic with representatives from PT, OT, nursing, and also the counseling fields, since we feel that it's not necessarily coincidental that the sorts of physical complaints that people are having, which are they are choosing to relate to their polio, which may or may not be related to polio, are also occurring during the famous midlife crisis. I didn't catch whether the Danes have midlife crises or not, but clearly in America now we're sort of fixated on that, and it may be more than coincidental. Another question that we have to answer for ourselves is, do all measures get applied to all patients or all people who come to clinics? Or should we have screening criteria and then, once we have identified problems, then proceed with more sophisticated testing for those particular people? I think we have to address very squarely and honestly the fact that we just don't have the money available in the medical system to do all that we could do for every patient. Now, what do I mean by that? During the meeting a year ago in St. Louis, I was talking to people who told me that their entire hospitalization and rehabilitation cost approximately $8,000 when they had that care delivered 30 years ago. Obviously, the dollar now is worth a great deal less dollar for dollar than it was then. But I think it would be relatively easy for us to run up a hospital bill of $8,000 in the routine evaluation of every patient who could come into a clinic. So we have to look at availability of resources as well as the needs of our patients. We also have to look at ethical ways of marketing clinics in order to attract people to come in and share their problems with us, so to give us an opportunity to interact with them, to help them and also help our own understandings. Well, what are our specific recommendations? They fall into the basic categories: history, physical examination, laboratory investigation, radiologic evaluation, and follow-up. Follow-up might consist of treatment, or it might consist only of monitoring. Under history, we are looking at present complaint, the reasons, if they're coming in with complaints, what their particular problems are. Also need to verify the diagnosis of the polio, and as we've heard presented in various forms this week, detailed information regarding the initial episode, if possible, including records, if possible. We need to include chronologic history of functional status since the time of onset of polio. And I think one key way to do this, since memory is sometimes fleeting with regard to how people were functioning at this age or that age, it might be good to key the history examination to such key life incidents as how were you like when you graduated from high school, when you graduated from college, when you got married, and so forth, to try to have an idea of what function was like at various key times in the lifetime of the patient. Past medical history in other regards is important, particularly with regard to medical intercurrent infections and the response to infections. Surgical procedures may not be specifically remembered, but the nature of recovery after those procedures might be remembered. Family history is important, both in terms of related neurological problems and also recognizing that we're talking about patients who may also have diabetes, who may also have a family predisposition to cardiovascular disease. And we should identify those risk factors for cardiovascular disease and pulmonary disease apart from the polio. We're learning that with our spinal cord injured folks now, incidentally, since we're doing a better job with the urinary tract. More and more people are dying of cardiovascular problems, and they're getting them earlier than you would predict because of the lack of appropriate conditioning and activity programs that may forestall cardiovascular disease. The review of symptoms will be terribly important in terms of identifying what is this thing called fatigue. It's such an ephemeral concept. We've talked about it, many people have used it, and I just don't think we have a good definition of that. But trying to specify how it fits into the general review of symptoms. Careful attention needs to be paid, too, to the bulbar signs and symptoms that were discussed, the sleep disorders, and various other things that have already been touched on today quite well. So I'm not going to detail them at this moment. Physical examination will be terribly important. The general examination, and then special attention to pulmonary problems, cardiovascular problems, and blood pressure. Some basic tests regarding autonomic function, I think, are appropriate. I didn't really know a whole lot about the serial sevens effect on peripheral vascular constriction and so forth. I can tell you that getting up in front of a group of people like this and talking about a great deal of material in a very short period of time will definitely promote peripheral vasospasm. Gastrointestinal function, I think particularly nutritional function, we have to look at. We're looking at this in spinal cord injury now too. Basic measurements are very simple to do. Skin fold thickness, circumference of arm or leg at standardized points. We can go and become even more sophisticated with weighing of the body underwater and so forth to calculate body fat content. But gathering basic information of this sort and then following over a period of time should be very important. Let's not forget, too, genitourinary evaluation. We heard some mention of the fact change in sexual function. Sexual changes are common with life, and whether or not they're attributed to polio, we don't know. But the basic examination should include a rectal examination with attention to the sphincter tone and control, bulbar cavernosus reflex, and anal cutaneous reflex. Dermatologic evaluation also seems appropriate since many folks with inactivity have problems in intertriginous areas and so forth. Biomechanical evaluation of the body, range of motion, joint alignment, stability, and so forth. We've seen good examples of that in Dr. Perry's talk yesterday. The sorts of extreme problems that can be observed, but we'd like to have the mild problems evaluated early and treated appropriately. Neurologic evaluation, we could spend the rest of the morning just talking about that. Now, what sorts of extended and expensive tests can we consider? Well, a dynamometry testing is really pretty simple and cheap. Cybex testing requires the equipment. Simple ability and agility testing can be done. Timed ambulation over a measured distance, time for transfer activities, time for ADL activities. These are simple things that can be done with a stopwatch in the clinic. Laboratory measurements, the routine ones, I think we have to always think in terms of preventive medicine, including serum lipid profile, serum protein studies, thyroid function, perhaps even B12 determinations if there's concern about other sorts of peripheral neuropathy. And basic pulmonary function testing, I think at least a simple protocol that's going to be applied across the board would be very appropriate. More advanced testing would include things such as Dr. Weekers has talked about with EMG, single fiber, macro EMG, and so forth. We'd like to have some sort of baseline testing done on populations of MMPI or some other psychometric test to see how much is life stress related, perhaps, and how much is related to response to chronic illness, chronic disability, not illness. Blood gases, ear oximetry, that sort of thing, very important. Exercise tolerance testing obviously has to be tailored very carefully to the patient because of their wide variation in physical capabilities. Work capacity and sleep lab evaluations would be very helpful. Radiologic evaluations for the chest. Some in our group thought that evaluation of the cervical spine would be very important because of the unusual patterns of neck weakness and use of the head and neck, particularly with people for those people who had profound upper extremity involvement with their original polio. And perhaps some basic simple testing regarding following osteoporosis in patients would be appropriate. I think that in conclusion, I'd like to say that the development of a standardized system for gathering data and sharing data would be really valuable. And we have experience with that with the regional spinal cord injury centers. It may very well be the contribution that spinal cord injury rehab makes back to polio rehab. You know, I've often been struck by how much spinal cord rehab owes to the rehab techniques that were developed for polio. And I think now that we may have an opportunity to turn around and use some of the technology we've developed for spinal cord injury research and follow-up for the sorts of clinical activities that we should be applying for our polio folk.
Great. Thanks very much, Ken. That took exactly 10 minutes and 30 seconds, so...
Sorry about that, 30 seconds.
In view of the time that we're trying to keep each of the reports to 10 minutes, when there is time for discussion, we will allow it. When there's not, we'll have to move on. So I'm going to call on Dr. Dalakis for the next presentation, which is on the issue of what are the key basic research questions to be addressed.
My role was to explore the future research plans, but before really we address them, the future research plans, we have to define where should we do research on, what kind of disease we're talking about. And I thought I should try to answer the question of taxonomy that Dr. Holsted raised earlier. From our experience, again, of 30 patients that were carefully examined, we have concluded that there are two subsets of problems in patients with old polio. One set of problems is a musculoskeletal and general medical in nature, i.e. joint pains, fatigue, decreased endurance, etc., which very often we believe stabilize at perhaps a slightly diminished, this patient stabilized at a slightly diminished level of functioning. These patients do not have lower motor neuron disease, new lower motor neuron disease. In addition, let me emphasize that we should not try to blame other medical problems or other neurological problems to the old polio. We should also remember that patients with old polio are not immune to and perhaps have the same chances as the non-polio patients to develop other medical and neurological problems. In addition, they have problems related to chronic disability, dependency on corrective devices, and the prolonged effects of corrective surgery on the joints and the spine. The second problem that we're interested in, and I think the research should be focused, is in the new motor neuron disease that some of these patients develop. We have defined this, and I don't know if this is an acceptable term, but we call it late progressive post-poliomyelitis muscular atrophy because it is slowly progressive, it is post-poliomyelitis, and it is muscular atrophy. It is not ALS because certainly it's not ALS. Its patients do not have the typical ALS findings. And it is not spinal muscular atrophy because spinal muscular atrophy is symmetrical and is usually bilateral, whereas the post-poliomyelitis muscular atrophy, the late PPMA, is a focal disease and rather asymmetric. Now, what research should be done in this particular, the late PPMA, which we believe it's a new motor neuron disease? Well, first of all, we should try to collect spinal cords from patients with old polio. And Dr. Tomlinson was interested to count the neurons in these segments of the spinal cord. The segment that he will be interested to evaluate is the lumbosacral spine, segment of the spinal cord. He can work on the frozen or the paraffin blocks. He prefers frozen, but he can work on the paraffin. In addition, both on the frozen and paraffin blocks, one can do in-situ hybridization to look for poliovirus. This can be done in certain centers in this country. The second future goal for the late PPMA will be to extend our immunological and virological studies to see whether patients with old polio, to see whether the new syndrome is related to an immunological disturbance or reactivation of the old polio. Our findings are very indicate that this may be the case in some patients. So what? But we need to study a large number of patients to have conclusive results. One may look at the subpopulation of lymphocytes, may stimulate the lymphocytes with poliovirus to see whether these lymphocytes are sensitized, to do HLA typing in patients who have symptoms and who do not have symptoms to see whether the patients with the subset of patients who develop new motor neuron disease are different, their genetic background is different from those that they do not. To look at the antibodies, for antibodies in the serum and the spinal fluid for several viruses, common viruses, and certainly for poliovirus, to look for abnormal immunoglobulins and the protein electrophoretic pattern in the spinal fluid. And if we indeed the finding of abnormal immunoglobulins in the CSF is confirmed, this can be further explored by eluting the bands and see whether this represents specific antibody to poliovirus or to a neuronal component. The other thing that can be done is to establish a model of chronic polio in monkeys. We have been thinking of that, to do that at NIH at least during the last 2 years. It was very difficult to do because we had problem with the housing of the animals. So you have to keep these animals for many years, and we didn't know where it was a technical problem where to put these animals. But if there is a facility somewhere, this can be done. Infect the animals with the polio and keep them for several years. And of course follow them up clinically and neurologically, etc. And the last thing is to establish a model of incomplete anterior horn cell disease. In other words, to try to have an animal with incomplete injury into the anterior horn cells and see what is happening to them, to the limbs that are innervated partially by them, these incompletely damaged neurons and the surrounding neurons. And one may exercise these limbs to see whether the exercise mass are more susceptible to further worsening. That's...
Thanks very much, Dr. Dalakis. We have 1 minute if anybody would like to either comment or add an additional item to the list.
Dr. Johnson, Columbus. Dr. Dalakis, how would you like the name Triple PMA? Because, see, if it's PP, post-polio progressive muscular atrophy, I would opt rather for progressive post-polio muscular atrophy. But anyway, there's three P's in front of it. Triple PMA.
Is that a research question?
It's a syntax.
Depends on your definition of research.
Yeah. Well, we put two P's, but I would feel comfortable with three.
The third P,
yeah. My name is Richard Owen from Minneapolis. I still have a concern over the choice of... the term, not so much that I'm nervous about myself having progressive muscular atrophy, which is a disease I know quite well, but if I introduce that term in Minnesota, where we have some strict constructionists in the neurology departments at the University of Minnesota, we would end up with a great deal of confusion based on the relationship of that term to progressive muscular atrophy.
No, I really think it's a different disease.
I'm not saying that you don't. Right. I agree with what you're thinking, that there's a disease. I'm saying that the hazard is that the first people have a short attention span and a short memory, and they're likely to remember three words better than the five or six that Ernie wants to put on the...
Maybe we just should leave it as triple P. And drop the MA so there's no confusion with relating this to a... muscular atrophy. Just call it progressive post-polio and let it go at that until we have a better definition.
The dangers with that is that the progressive post-polio, it may indicate that it is a generalized disease like a polio was, but the distinction is that this is really a focal disease and very slowly progressive. We see...
Well, but we're not sure that it's really...
Well, it may be generalized after 20 years, I don't know, but at the moment it appears to be focal and very slowly progressive.
How about progressive polio, post-polio paralysis?
It's not paralysis. It's mild weakness. It's
paresis. Paresis. Progressive polio paresis.
I'd like
Let's
to take,
keep trying.
No, I'd like to take the... I'd like to take the prerogative of the moderator to suggest that perhaps in due course we will form a nomenclature committee which will wrestle with this issue. I think we need more information before we can, and perhaps there are indeed many syndromes or problems that we're dealing with. And to sort them out, I think, will take more time than we have right now.
What are we going to tell the news media, since I see United Press International is in our midst? What are we going to call this? I think that is something we really need to resolve today, because the news media is going to call it something, and that name is going to stick. So it's better that we pick the name today rather than letting the news media pick it for us.
I think weakness is a word that's very readily understandable, and I don't know that there's an awful lot of people that end up with atrophy, so I'd shy away from that at all costs. So I would opt for progressive weakness. I don't care whether words are added to that, but I would use progressive weakness, because that seems to me to be the one that most people complain of. They never walk into your office and say, I'm progressively atrophying. They come in and they say, I'm progressively getting weaker.
So you said that the press is here today. I think it's very important to identify this is only a small segment of the population. A lot of them have just plain old mechanical strain, yeah, joints and ligaments. I think that distinction has to be made, that you really have two clinical entities.
I just to keep people informed of the conversation going on up here, Dr. Dalakis has just acceded to Dr. Herbison's suggestion, which I think was a good one, which is to entertain the thought of calling it post-polio progressive weakness.
Or the other thing you could do is call it post-polio syndromes.
No. Nice try, John. We like you a lot, but... Dr. Bailey.
I hate to add more confusion to what we're saying, but I very much object to the progressive part of it, because the patients we've had that we have put on rest, and that you yourselves have said they've improved on exercise and that sort of thing, I'm not convinced that it's going to continue to be progressive. I know at this point they're at a point of losing strength and all, but the fact of continued progression I don't think has been established, and I object to that strongly.
I'm concerned that we're trying to control what people out there are going to think, and that is impossible. I think the best we can do is take the information we have. Time is limited. We've got some good suggestions. Why don't you and I, in forming the press release, we'll use our best judgment. I hope that you all will trust us to do that. I don't think it'll be the last word. We cannot control what the press will say, how they will interpret it. We've already had reports that there have been misstatements, misinterpretations of what's going on here. That is part of the interaction with ourselves and the world out there. It's going to continue. We're not going to be able to control it.
What we ought to do is just see a show of hands, so we have a little idea of the feeling of the group. How many would not be greatly offended by the term post-polio progressive weakness? How many? Is there anyone who would be offended by that term?
Offended, but I have some hang-ups with it.
How many people would be offended by the term post-polio syndrome? How many people like that term, post-polio syndrome?
For part of the problem. It's not the whole problem.
Well, that didn't help a bit, did it? Okay.
What's wrong with late effects of polio? Until we know better, it's a good one.
Late effects of polio. Well,
all those opposed to late effects of polio.
How many are opposed to the late effects of polio?
That's general. Dr. Miller has his hand up.
Dr. Dalakis, you just spent... Yes. Trying to separate out one syndrome from any other syndrome. If you care to bump them all together as a general problem, which clearly is what the symposium is discussing, that's fine. But in terms of research,
yes.
And in terms of identifying individual problems, then it's probably best we keep some type of separation that he's trying to formulate.
I think we can talk about the late effects of polio and also about the post-polio progressive muscular atrophy or weakness as a separate entity of that late effects of polio. Yeah,
there are subgroups, indeed. We're going to, yes, let's move on to the third report.
Do you like to go next?
Yeah.
Yes, Dr. Maynard, on clinical research.
I haven't joined in the fracas. I was waiting for the microphone, but I guess I better pass and Steve can keep to the topic. Our group discussed the clinical research questions that we thought would be most important. And the first one was really, what is the natural history of muscle strength in post-polios? I think that's what we've been talking about. And a couple sub-issues under that general heading are the obvious need for a protocol that uses objective measurements that are better than manual muscle testing for longitudinal follow-up studies on muscle strength. Some of the ideas that our group discussed, I think you've heard before, but for the record, include Cybex ergometrics, including dynamometers. One that hadn't been talked about before was stimulated muscle tension and amplitude of the evoked muscle response. I believe the one that stimulated muscle tension had to do with an electrical stimulation to the appropriate nerve during a maximum isometric contraction of the muscle to see if there was in fact further increase in amplitude. Second major question area was, what is the effect of exercise on muscles weakened by previous polio? And what are the parameters of safe and effective or the parameters of potentially harmful exercise programs? The ideas that the group generated that relate to answering that question included CPKs, discussion of the various EMG recordings that you've talked about. One participant discussed the use of 3-methylhistidine to creatinine ratios as a potential metabolic indicator of muscle damage. And again, we need objective parameters for strengthening exercise prescriptions that then can be tried out and evaluated through follow-up of muscle strength or these others. Third major question was, how do we classify patient groups of post-polios to study? And I think we've just finished that discussion at some length. And the only agreement I'm hearing from the group is that there are at least 2 major clusters of patients. I guess I started out saying that in my report, and I've heard that from several other people. There are the big group of pain and motion problems that are causing people increasing symptoms and difficulties. And then there is the whole question of muscle weakness and fatigue. And that's one of the problems I have with just labeling it weakness, is that there's also the fatigue and endurance factor that relate to it. I will editorialize briefly on the issue of the spinal muscular or the post-polio muscular atrophy, because not only is atrophy not prominent, but to me, if you use that term, you're implying that the anterior horn cell is indeed the problem the explanation for the clinical problems. And I was very impressed with Dr. Weaker's data that suggests it may be a peripheral effect on the axons, on the terminal sprouts and the muscle fibers. And so I'm a little uneasy with that term for that reason. Syndrome, I think, is an old-fashioned word describing a cluster of symptoms. And I think if you get specific as to what symptoms you're including under that syndrome, it still has some potential usefulness. But going on, next question, what is the best way then to predict the onset of late respiratory failure in old polios with respiratory muscle involvement? That's another, I think, important research question. Certainly, again, it's a smaller subset of the overall polio population that are running into respiratory problems, but we need to certainly understand that further. Some other ones that I can go through a little quicker. How does one measure objectively muscle fatigue? We need some good clinical parameters to look at that question to verify that people do have abnormal fatigue and how it may change. Next question is, what is the origin of muscle pain? We've had a lot of discussions about muscle pain in old polios. And what do we mean by that, and what can we do to measure it or learn more about it? Next, what are the habitual patterns of overuse that the people are doing that may relate to their increasing problems? Another one is, are there circulatory and autonomic changes in post-polios, and what is their clinical significance? Particularly, does it at all relate to our question of the increasing or the decreasing strength in endurance? Another one is, what are the effects of chronic strain on muscle and on connective tissue over the years, and how does this relate to our clusters of problems? Another one is, what are the clinical outcomes of the orthopedic deformities that are frequently a residual of polio? What is their natural history and their clinical significance? How does the effect of increasing weakness or chronic strain change them? And then lastly, what is the relationship between the measured strength and the tension and force produced during exercise? I think those were the major questions we discussed. I hope I saved a little time for questions.
Not really, Fred, because we are behind from the other.
We used up so much on the other one, didn't
we? Yes. But I appreciate your keeping it short. I'd like to call on Dr. Taylor to summarize the comments regarding education and dissemination.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over now to continue listening on side two.